Hey, he's back. State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy is joining us on April Fool's version of Tacky Talk. Hey,
I'm
Tacky.
not really, I'm not really here. April Fool's everyone. This is a AI image you're looking at.
We've missed you the past couple of weeks, but good to have you back. Good to talk to you, and thanks for spending some time with us.
Yeah, sorry guys for not being around for a little bit. I've been a little crazy at work and a little bit under the weather too, so you might hear a few sniffles coming out of me.
Yes, it is allergy season now that we're in April, for sure. Things will be blooming, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, I've felt that for the last few days. I know it's not a cold. There's no cold symptoms, though, other than the fact that, yeah, step outside is when it hits you. Also, the cranes are back on the Sailor's Pond and Rice Road. Everything coming south is coming north. We have geese in the marsh and ducks are back. All the birds are flowing back up to Massachusetts.
Nice, and the daffodils are out at Peacefield, so spring has definitely sprung.
It has, despite the fact it was freezing on Sunday.
Yes, I hope it warms up soon so we can turn off our heat. Let's talk about the utilities here in Massachusetts, Tacky.
But how screwed up they are, because you saw
Yes.
Channel 5 New yesterday, Channel 5
Yes.
Invincible, their screwed up billing system.
Yes.
Oh, this is a shocking. Utility companies do one thing super well, bill you.
They never miss.
They never miss. I mean, working at the AG's office many moons ago, that was the one consistent thing. No matter what they get you in, they were good at billing people. And it's shocking they missed 53,000 bills. I think my mom was one of them because my mom got a bill and she didn't remember the other one. I'm like, that's not possible. Utility companies do one thing perfectly well is to bill you.
That's right.
So this is absolutely shocking. And the utility system doesn't like messing with billing, meaning that every time we try to change the law regarding how you bill, as well as what you want to see in your bill, you always get pushback from the utility company because they're afraid of adversely affecting the billing systems. And we know it's automated. It's always been automated at some level. Upgrades are constant. I remember fighting utility companies about, what they can and cannot add to a bill. Can they slip things in a bill? Can they put notices outside the bill itself, et cetera, et cetera. And there's always resistance. And I would like to know exactly how this happened. I'm sure the DPU will release more information to the press. I've not got an email yet. I probably will from National Grid and the DPU about what happened here. But yeah, there's a refund involved and it's going to be fined $50 million, it looks like, from DPU on its own. So, customers that got a bill missed, it looks like there's going to be some assistance from the utility regarding penalties and whatnot. And our rates are going to get a mild adjustment of $15 million as a fine. Now, just so you know, when you have $15 million and you have 1 point like 5-ish million customers, I mean, it's you're getting a buck a piece,
Right.
$1 a piece. So, but it's still something because it affects the bottom line. And it's not recoverable, meaning you can't recover from you for those fines. So but it is shocking. It is shocking that he screwed up billing. I'm absolutely shocked by that.
And my question is, what the heck is going on at the Department of Public Utilities that they didn't catch this and allowed this to go on for so long?
Well, people have heard me say this in the press. Do your job. You can add your own explicitives next to that word. And they are ratepayer paid. They're paid by your electric and gas bills. I mean, they are not taxpayer paid. It's one of those few agencies that if they need more resources, we add 0.00001 cent per kilowatt hour to your bill, which is, minuscule to operate an agency that represents well under a thousandth of a penny to operate. So actually probably 10,000th of a penny, actually. It's not that much to run DPU. So they're so hyper focused on these other things that they forget they're a customer service agency. And this was my complaint during the Volpatrick administration, straight into the Baker administration. And I have serious concerns here about the operations into the Heal administration of the DPU. People who are a little bit older may remember that the DPU used to be under administration and finance. secretary, and it had a lot more quasi-independence. Under the Deval Patrick administration, DPU became, quote unquote, an environmental agency, which it is not, because in the state, we do not do generation. We are a deregulated energy state. DPU does not set the rates. DPU does not set the policy regarding energy supply. The legislature sets that policy. So, they treat it like an agency that does environmental through energy sources, but we by law set the energy sources for U.S. customers. And by competitive supply encourages more renewable power options because that is where the public would like to go. And over the last 20 plus years, the public likes renewable energy sources as part of their energy supply. So I don't know what's wrong over there, because to me, it's a customer service oriented agency, not an environmental agency. And this has always been my kind of like craw with three administrations now about how they treat DPU.
Right, yeah, they seem to have lost their focus, and I recall too that they were in charge of public transportation at the time too.
Yeah, they had a weird section regarding Ubers, taxis, and towing companies. They set those rates and they set the oversight. But again, they're an agency where funding is not a problem. It's bodies. And whether or not the administration has the will to hire more people or pay for better expertise, because finding an engineer that knows something of gas pressurization and implementation and distribution system is not just any civil engineer, right? This is what government runs to a bit of a problem, because when we need to hire specialized assistants or specialized personnel, you're either going to have to contract them or you have to steal them from a private company. And it becomes a salary issue. The
Yeah, they
medical
can make much more in the private sector, I'm sure. Yeah.
well, the medical examiner's office is another one that has a huge problem keeping and hiring, because they're competing in a healthcare shortage where hospitals and doctors groups are paying top dollar for medical personnel, and we're paying like not even two-thirds market rate.
Yeah.
Now, I understand the public, likes to keep the expenses down. Trust me, I get it. But you try to hire people in a medical examiner's office where you're paying them two-thirds.
Yeah. It's not gonna be competitive, right?
And we do higher to market rate to attract them. Taxpayers lose their minds.
Yeah.
Because it just takes one Boston Globe article, a Boston Herald article, talk about salary structures again. But they don't
Yeah.
do it in context. Right? You just see this person making a lot of money. And don't get me wrong, I see some salaries like, really? Because I actually know what the job is. But if you see a salary saying medical examiner's office and you see there's a large salary, you can be like, oh, this is outrageous. But do you know what the market rate is for that same profession in the private sector?
Right. Yeah, that's the bigger question, right?
So when you all like get upset about our salaries, rightfully so, make sure you look at the context of the salary and the job relative to the private sector amount to determine what's going on here, because there's only so much we can do. Same thing on a unionized job. Some of the union jobs have salary caps. They can only get so much based on years of service, and there's a cost of living adjustment. But to try to pay more than that base amounts can be a bit of a problem, depending on what union you're talking about.
Yeah. So does the DPU have enforcement powers?
Yeah, they have the ability to fine, suspend, and in the worst case scenario, revoke a franchise. So, in an extreme scenario, for example, they could revoke National Grid's franchise as the provider of utility. Problem is that you need a replacement utility before you can revoke a franchise.
Yeah. Like they did with Columbia Gas, right?
That's essentially what they did, a forced sale.
Right.
So essentially, it's a franchise revocation, but based on a forced sale.
Yeah.
But they also did that Unitil back after the ice storm. They were
Oh.
looking for a new owner, and it became National Grid in the end. It wasn't a forced sale, but the fine issued in the ice storm exceeded their profits.
Gotcha. So, okay.
Makes them bankrupt the company. So obviously, we didn't bankrupt the company because I worked on that case 20 plus years ago.
Yeah.
And obviously, that was not proper. You can't bankrupt a utility because then you literally just no one has power anymore. Just close the
Right.
shop. So eventually, the fines had to be distributed over a longer period of time inside their profit structure, and then basically just reduce the profits over a long period of time. And then eventually, they had to sell out because there's no way this was sustainable.
Gotcha. Okay. Oh, it's complicated.
Yeah, again, it's in simple because you get a byline of three sentences doesn't always translate well when you get into the weeds. And I'm a
Right.
victim of that too. Don't get me wrong. I'll see like a byline and I freak out about it. But then, I have to like take a deep breath and think about it for a second.
And read about it and delve into it. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, there's no shortage of information. You don't like one source, read another one. I do read and watch multiple sources of information. And better for worse, this job has me always like filtering through the noise to try to get out, take out the adjectives and the adverbs.
Yeah, and the politics of it too, right?
Oh, there's a lot of color. Color is how you sell papers, unfortunately. You know that.
That's right. That's why we have tacky talk. We cut through all that.
We try to, or at least
Absolutely.
try to bring some people to, calm down and give it a second thought.
Yeah. So it is actually pretty quiet right now on Beacon Hill, right?
Yeah, committees are, I won't get into too deep into the technicals, but the committees are formed. They're trying to set up schedules. It's a bit of an unusual process because rules are still in conference committee, but unlike previous sessions where the committees move forward into temporary rules, there seems to be more of a sincere effort in terms of House and Senate leadership to actually create rules. And it'll be a shakeup. You may have seen the paper, but branches have really decided to change operational methods on the joint committees regarding chair responsibilities, which we're all kind of feeling around ourselves, trying to figure out what that really means. Well, it's the explicit explanation on the rules themselves that hasn't been approved yet. Yeah, I know. You're playing a game with old rules, but new rules are coming, but you don't know what to do, and the game's already started.
So it sounds like it's in a holding pattern at the moment.
Well, it's like, let me see if I can use a baseball analogy, right? You start the game with one set of rules, and then by the third inning, you're told that there might be new rules coming, but don't stop playing. And then, by the seventh or the eighth inning, you might have completely different rules before the game is over.
During the same game. Okay.
We're in the same game. So this is kind of the problem as a chair. I'm trying to navigate mentally, with my Senate co-chair, like how we're navigating this. So, we got to be prepared to perhaps pivot quickly if the House of Senate leadership comes up with rules in the midst of the game, because we're told not to stop, just go, and get these things done.
But you might
So
have to do some things over again if the rules change, right?
that is the fear that I'm having.
Yeah.
So yeah, again, inside baseball, not your problem, public. This is a operational issue that I have to navigate with my co-chair, my staff, on keeping it efficient while. You can't anticipate change. Predicting the future always gets you in trouble. But get ready to have some flexibility in case things change.
So what? Why? Why all this turmoil, Tacky?
It goes back ancient history, back to Stan Rosenberg when he was the Senate president back in 2016. Actually, yeah, 16. So he proposed an idea to bifurcate the two committees. But not bifurcate them, meaning we stop joint committees and have Senate House committees, but you still want the House committee staff to do all the work. And it became a bit of a problem. And it became a management style of the Senate that we want everything we want. And some reason they thought, well, unicameral, the House didn't matter. And it is a unicameral, is a bicameral system, which the two sides need to figure out how to get along. And
I see.
it's this is a country that's bicameral, except for Nebraska, which is unicameral. So since then, the House and Senate leaderships have been having issues regarding rules because the shift in philosophy in the Senate, which has not changed, despite having Stan Rosenberg, Harriet Chandler, and now Karen Spilka on the third Senate president. And the House has always adopted the position we don't really change the system that has been broken for 100 years. You guys want to break something that has been broken. But now the issue has come up that the House is willing to negotiate perhaps changing severe change in the system in 100 years of committee structure. And then the rules system hasn't changed since rules reform in 1994. Actually, it was approved, I think, started in 93, but it was approved in 1994 before I started. Actually, I've only lived in the current rule structure with some modifications. So I've seen the evolution up close and personal of the internal rule structure, and 95% of it hasn't changed. But that also changes our calendar. So we actually don't know when recess is going to be anymore. So, you guys know I'm single, so I have some, flexibility. But if you have a family and expectations, you're taking kids someplace for vacation at some stage, or they're going to divorce you. You need to know what the calendar looks like.
Sure.
And
Wow. Okay.
every legislature in the country has a calendar. People have some degree of predictability of when formal sessions are and when deadlines are for committees are, and when your expectations are supposed to be where and when. And of course, some states like Texas have special sessions because they only show up once, only once half of a year. While other states like Hawaii shows up 6 months and they literally do nothing else. Like they don't exist. They don't do constituent services, no committee work, just go away. So it's, well, do they constituent services? No, they're not staffed, actually. There is no, outside of formal session, there is no staff in Hawaii. I met a Hawaiian legislator trying to explain us the staffing problem. So they operate basically one solid year because they only meet 6 months a year, every year or 2 years. And then they have one full year, actually, of 2 years where they have literally no staff.
Wow, so sounds like so the governor there has a lot of power.
Enormous power. Yep.
Yeah.
Enormous power. So generally, when you have a legislature that's least available for informal sessions, we can always leverage against the governor somehow. But yeah, states that have very little sessions will end up having a lot more power put in the hands of the governor.
Yeah, interesting. It's interesting to get perspective on the way other things are happening. You would think here, though, Massachusetts with the Democratic majority, everybody kind of get along.
Oh, no. Democrat Party is very diversified here. It's very popular.
Oh,
I think people always make a mistake, and it's very popular political fodder that you have the supermajority party, so everything goes one way. It's easier when you're Republicans to say that because duh, the numbers say that.
right.
But everybody knows we're not clones. I like to keep reminding folks we're not a monolith, and you have a diversification of not just political views, political spectrum, but also constituent views. And I'm a coastal city. We're near Boston. We compete with resources from Boston in terms of state funding and whatnot. But I mean, I don't know what it's like representing a valley. Like you from Merrimack Valley, I have no clue what it's like representing
Yeah,
a
or
community.
the islands are completely different, sure, yeah.
Yeah. So you have competing interests on a constituent level and geography regarding your needs, at the state level. It's not like Congress, where at this point, I don't think they do any constituent work in terms of their fighting because they don't do earmarks in a conventional manner. We never hear about bills that specifically affect certain regions of the country anymore. It's these kind of macro issues that consume the news. The same thing happens here with the media. People get caught up in our big bills, but no one ever talks about like the $10 million in relief we provided the agricultural industry after the monster floods, up in the northeast, northwest corner of the state. Or many years ago, where one of the routes along the Vermont border was completely wiped out by mudslide. State had to drop, $5 million instantly to try to restore that road because it's the only road that you, literally the only interstate road in the geographic zone. It literally stopped everything.
Right.
Mass Highway had to go in there fast, and just drop everything else to try to get it done and any appropriate funding. Like no one ever talks about, when we have deep freezes and the homeless shelters need a stop gag for a short period of time, we drop some quick money there. Or, during the nine during like the Boston bombing, we were in formal sessions, beefing up our security, but also putting emergency laws temporarily in place to catch bombers.
Yep.
So those are things that kind of lost. People talk about the fact that, we're a full-time legislature, but are we really? And yeah, you can always say that's the exception to the rule, but if the rules weren't in place the way they are now, then everything I said could never have happened.
Sure. Yeah, I see. Learn from past experience. Yeah.
You've been around long enough and you experienced long enough, you can see contextually how this works. And again, criticism is very rightfully allowed. I mean, it's not like you don't do it. I do it too. I'm very critical even where I work. That being said, though, people only see, the stuff that's big, but they forget all the little things that we did to keep the government running.
Speaking of national politics, we haven't touched on that lately.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Tomorrow is quote unquote Liberation Day when it comes to these new tariffs that are going to be imposed. I'm wondering if there's any girthing for it here in Massachusetts.
Well, everything along the Canadian border is adversely affected, including ourselves, right? Hydro-Québec is one of our major power suppliers, not just for Massachusetts, but for the entire Northeast Corridor, right down to New York. And it's clean power, it's cheap power, but it may not be cheap power if Hydro-Québec and the Quebec government decides to do what Ontario tried to do, is cut everybody off and increase its charges on it by adding fees and things on their side. And you're kind of held hostage because on your baseline supply. And you want clean power, hydro's it. Adversely, things like the lumber industry and others where they have cross transport, like Maine's very agriculturally tied to Canada. And that's going to be very problematic on tar in the tariff. And like I said before, the Trump administration's decided to do a targeted tariffs. But exactly what does that mean? Other countries very clearly are doing targeted tariffs based on local industry. So they have local industry that can pick up the slack on reduction of U.S. product. They're trying to reduce the damage and impact to customers. Yes, they're going to pay more, but it keeps local jobs in place and also tries to keep some less damage and price impact in those countries. So they're not doing blankets. They're picking where they have domestic replacements, and they're going to try to reduce as much as possible damage on consumers. Blanket tariffs don't do that. Blanket tariffs, you get hit everywhere and nobody knows exactly what it means to you. And does it really encourage domestic product? Depends, right? Not all manufacturing is coming back to the United States. People think a factory can just get built tomorrow. You got to find a location, you got to find a workforce. There's a workforce shortage in this country. There's an energy shortage because you can't build energy everywhere in this country. You need water and sewer to operate a factory or any kind of complex. And then you still have to get past like local zoning, financing, environmental regulations,
You
fight
need
the neighbors, fighting
transportation
the local
access.
government, transportation access, educated workforce. That's a big thing. During the 90s, foreign car companies built plants here where Ford and GM and Chrysler back then abandoned. So not like they went everywhere, but foreign companies were looking for places that had already a pre-existing workforce where an American car company left it behind. Not for every plant, but obviously that's logical. And again, a manufactured project may cross state lines multiple times. So it comes, we send a raw product over. It's converted into a component part of something, goes back to the US, is added to another component part of something bigger, sit back on the line again to be a continuation of the back and forth of putting an assembly of some product. And that gets tariffed multiple times every time it comes over. It's not just
Right. Yeah, if you look at labels on some products, it'll say, designed here, assembled here, manufactured here, all different.
yeah. And then you also have, like the shoe business, the soles one tariff, the laces are another tariff, the tops are another tariff, the stitches are another tariff. It gets really complex for these businesses. So, it's going to be a high administrative cost to these industries. And the Trump administration talks about like Walmart's ability to leverage Chinese manufacturers like they did in 2016. Well, this isn't 2016, it's 2025. So 2000, yeah, 17, sorry. It's 8 years later. So it's not the 8 years of when it was 8 years ago. And by the way, Walmart can leverage, but you tell me that your chocolatier down the street from us in Quincy, or some of those boutique shops and tailors, or the florists down the street, you think they have the ability to leverage like Walmart? Let's be real here, folks. We learned during COVID that half our economy is driven by small businesses, your mainstream business we all look at every day down walking down the street. These tariffs have a large impact on smaller businesses and large corporations. So when the Trump administration says that the foreign companies keep their tariffs, maybe, but most likely not, because 50% of our businesses, our economy is small business.
And that impacts the people who work there as well.
And the wholesalers know they're going to be able to pass those costs more easily than the large corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, China's in a economic stagflation situation where they're trying to recover their economy, not by consumer consumption, but they're trying to recover the economy by over-exporting. And they're not going to be able to meet these tariffs like the Trump administration did in 2017, 18, and 19. They're going to have to pass the cost because there's no way that you're going to try to recover your economy on over-exporting, which is a global problem, by the way, not just a U.S. problem. And try to recover their economy that way because they lose money in that situation. And the yuan is still 7.2 to US dollar to RMB. Historically, it's always been 6.5, 6.6. So us buying Chinese goods is cheap because their dollar's very, their money's very weak against our dollar.
Sure. Yeah.
It's cheaper than it's ever been because our dollar's so strong.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that US dollar index has gone down, I'm not seeing massive shifts on the major currencies, which
Right.
is kind of funny because the dollar index measures the US dollar against multiple major currencies to try to get the average. And it's, again, they're trying to do like 50 things at the same time, thinking they can coalesce in one place. But you and I will feel the impact over longer periods of time. And I said before, we are the biggest consumer on the planet of imports, by over 2 times the next biggest country. 3 times bigger than Germany, 2 times bigger than China. We have still wage growth. We're not in recession. We're the only country that's not had a recession like other countries. And you didn't notice the tariff impact because you were making more money in 2017, 18, 19. Well, now you're in a different economic situation. And consumers are now pulling back their spending because they're not sure what's going on.
Right.
And like that time, now you're having real foreign impact. Canadians are not coming to America. 70% of all bookings have been canceled.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and the favorite places to visit aren't surprising. They like you to go to the warm states.
Sure.
So it's like Florida. Canadians like going to places like Florida. They want to go to Disney World. They want to go to Anaheim. They want to go to the amusement parks in warm locations, right? During the summer, we'll get them, right? During the Northeast, right? Particularly, we have Spelgring, a 250th anniversary of the Alexia and Concord. So that is like a fun thing for just people to come see from around the world, right? So it's $1.44 Canadian to $1. It used to be $1.25 before COVID to US dollar. The money's weaker, but they want to come to the States vacation. 70% of all bookings have been canceled, and real estate's impacted too. Canadians have stopped buying real estate, not just residential, but also business. Canceled a lot of contracts already in the US on real estate purchases on both residential and commercial real estate. They're the biggest supporter of our real estate business, particularly in warmer areas, particularly along the Sun Belt. So, people kind of feel this. You've upset not necessarily just the country, you've upset people. Regular people in Canada is upset with us, not just a government issue.
No, they're taking it personally.
Yeah, some of you may not think that's important until they don't show up. I mean, Expedia, something's bad when Expedia has offered me 25 key one key dollars if I book a trip between before May 31st. Bookings.com offered me $15 to book a hotel somewhere in the US before May 31st. I mean,
Just trying to entice you,
yeah, when they offer you money to do something, they got a problem.
So it's the last ditch effort, it sounds like,
When Expedia is paying you, I know it's $25, but when they're paying you something to do something, that's bad. I mean, Best Buy sent me a $10 must buy a product certificate to buy something in the month of March and giving you $10 to buy something. It's like, there's a problem.
If they can afford to do that, then they're worried that things are going to be bad.
And they've also inadvertently created a higher trade surplus because the mega companies like Costco and Walmart, has been importing like crazy the last 4 months in anticipation of tariffs. So the warehouses are fully stocked to try to forego as long as possible spikes in prices. But like I say constantly through this is that if you're a business and you need to pay customs up front to get your stuff out, you don't like paying parts. You have to pay customs now as a wholesaler. You're not going to wait until that happens. You're going to charge customers today so they have the money ready for the tariffs to buy things at the wholesaler level because the wholesaler is going to pass the cost along.
Right.
It is the US wholesaler that pays the price of the tariffs. So, they always spin in news. I just look at the news like this is not, I mean, if you have an iota of like basic understanding of capitalism, you just like, this makes no sense. And then, the economy's slowing, unemployment is going to tick up a little bit. The federal government layoffs will show some unemployment tick up. States, we won't feel it the same way here in Massachusetts as like Virginia, Washington, D.C., Texas, California. Those states are huge federal employees in there. And all the so-called red states have a lot of federal employees. So, as these trim down of government continues, the unemployment's going to tick up faster, and particularly, honestly, the Republican states have the most government employees and anything that's close to DC or a military base. And then once they hit the contractors, I mean, you cut off 800, $100 million out of $100 billion out of a hit $800 billion military budget. That means, $100 billion worth of contracts are going to get canceled.
It's, I wonder too. I mean, there are federal unions. I'm wondering how they're able to subvert that.
Well, they just challenged him in court.
Okay.
I mean,
Yeah.
this was people don't know Donald Trump's history when he was a developer in New York. He regularly just forced people to go to court against him and relied on his largeness to basically beat people into administration, beat people into a submission at the court level where they just couldn't keep up with the legal fees.
Okay.
Until he hit a business equal in size or larger, force a settlement. In this case, it's the federal government. So, there's a lot of questions coming up of whether or not the administration will comply with judges' rulings, because the enforcement mechanism against them is called Congress. And, Congress clearly doesn't like being part of government. I mean, I'm a legislative kind of mentality, and I really am big on preserving legislative power. Against the governor, I really am, because I'm a legislator. If doesn't matter who the president is, if every time you abdicate power of any kind to the executive branch, you're not getting it back.
It's fascinating to watch just from a historical perspective.
It's not new. I mean, since the days of Washington, there's always a test between the three branch of government, the federal level. Even at the state level, who has what authority, right? I mean, Robert Madison put all the power of interpretation laws in the court system, period. Right? The president has always tried to exert more power during times of war, and then the legislative branch, Congress, tries to repeal some of that during terms of peace. It doesn't matter what decade we're talking about, right? And sometimes it was irrational. Declarations of war, like the War of 1812, probably should never have happened, to be frank with you. Congress got kind of uppity and decided to declare war against the British, and they're probably going to handle it diplomatically. That's always been a head scratcher war in my history book reading. I'm like, why did this happen again?
I see. Interesting.
Right. I mean, sometimes the congressional branch doesn't, the executive branch doesn't always sync up on things like that. The War of 18, so when it comes to mind,
Well, the
but.
same questions were raised about the first Iraq War, too.
Oh yes, and also the Patriot Act, right? The it's a train back of our civil rights, pre-9/11, post-9/11, the change of immigration pre-9/11, post-9/11. There's too many generation of folks now who grew up in post-9/11. They realize what the civil rights were pre-9/11. There was a lot more rights had, less surveillance, despite the Cold War, and you actually had a much more fairer, and people understood the immigration policy better than you do post 9/11. So again, that's 30, what, 20, 24 years ago.
91, I think, was the first.
Yeah, no, post 9/11. So
Oh, which was 2001, yeah.
2001. So yeah, 24 years ago. So I mean, you
Yeah.
got, you know, fully two generations of kids that have no idea.
Right. Interesting. Well, in your holding pattern at Beacon Hill, what's your committee going to try and do, Jackie?
Well, we're going to hit some low-hanging fruit first. So one of the new rules the House has imposed is to have House bills go to the House, and they want all bills reported out within 60 days, meaning some kind of action after the hearing is done, which means I have to do a lot of planning before the hearing begins. So working with my Senate counterpart, I'm going to knock out of the committee all the low-hanging technical bills I talk about ad nauseum on this on with you that are boring as anything, but they're just technical small bills about continuing education, term changes, things like that. So that's going to be the first round of bill releases, the unexciting stuff. And then we'll see what happens on the complex issues, like right to repair is back on the docket because it's now an enforcement. AG can enforce it. And we're waiting to see what the car companies do. Honda has already told the car new dealers officially now that they're going to disable all telematics, which means they're going to turn off the entire GPS wireless systems in the cars remotely or by dealer repairs. And then they're going to stop selling cars where they can't turn off those remote functions. So you're going to see less Honda cars being sold in Massachusetts, and you're not going to see the electric cars at all. So I'm waiting to see what the other car manufacturer is going to do in compliance, because it's not just about providing this wireless information to your third-party car repair shops anywhere you travel, they can get the information. But also, they're supposed to create this uniform portal where a car repair shop can go to everybody's car once through this portal, and the consumer can get to this portal somehow, and you can talk to your car directly to your phone. A lot of question marks about data security on that. We talked about this before. I mean, once you open a door, the door is open. And technology is generally a two-way street in communication. So you have to transmit information out, but then you have to tell the computer, what you're looking for on the way back. And the door is now open. And it's a huge data
And
security.
anybody can walk through,
Yeah, a hacker can walk through because the door is open, and you may put a lot of locks on it. You may put a screen on it. You may put a doggy door on it to try to limit the size of what's coming out. But the reality, a good enough hacker is, you've seen in the news, there's no shortage.
And now everybody's phones are connected to their cars, and your phone gives you access to your home, your financial information, everything.
And that's the huge data concern in your car. So I'm not sure how this is going to play out still. So, we'll see if Honda holds up their continuation of their belief that this is what they need to do. Subaru already turned off a lot of the telematics, like OnStar's not available in Subaru. You paid for it, but you're like, oh, I don't have it anymore. Well, it's a consumer violation. It's not a consumer violation if it's a law. And by the way, this is not my law. This is voter approved. So
That's
you
right.
can't blame me for this one, folks. I didn't do it. The voters did this one. So I love it when I get blamed for stuff the voters did. But I mean, I don't know what we're going to do yet. I'm waiting for information from the various car companies to talk about this. Motorcycles, RVs, and heavy machinery is also affected. Like everyone from Caterpillar to John Deere to Harley-Davidsons are also affected by this, and the big RVs as well. So a lot of huge question marks floating out there about this. And also, how do you enforce? Do you just stop selling these cars? Do you find these companies? I mean, what happens? And then there's going to be competitive disadvantage between different car manufacturers because some may better turn certain systems off and some may not turn off others. Now, just remind folks, this is cars models 2022 and older. So if you bought a model 2022 and newer, sorry, not older, newer, my mistake, newer, 2022 onward, it is subject to this law that voters approved.
Interesting.
Yeah, don't be surprised the computer system turns off.
Great.
Oh, I got a 2018 because that was my last big car purchase, and it's been 8 years and my debt's paid off, so I'm not buying a new car anytime soon.
I think a lot of people are gonna, well, between that and the tariff situation, I think that's gonna be the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, 20, well, potential 25% tariff for new cars, but it's a little tricky because all the cars have different parts. So it's a lot of little math, and it's a lot of math involved in terms of identifying each tariff, each part, and trying to figure out how to or not, should it not increase the price structure based on each individual component of the tariff. They try to keep it simple by saying 25% and do easy math for you, but it's not that easy because your knobs come from Indonesia, for example, to the US to be assembled. But those are all your knobs, which is true. We saw this during COVID. Cars couldn't be made to spec because we're missing a knob. You buy an incomplete car, which is a consumer violation. So then, that knob's a certain tariff. Now, is that worth passing the cost to the customer? I don't know. Right? But your, parts of the car are made inside the US. That's not subject to the tariff. So certain parts, let's just pick a random part. Let's say there's a electronic piece made in Massachusetts, one of the electronics, not subject to tariff. So that part of the car won't be subject to tariff. So the manufacturer's got a really interesting problem here, right? You got all these different components, some domestic, some not, all with different tariffs. What is your solution? Do you try to break down the price increase on each individual component, or you just slap just a big number on it and call it good?
Wow, that's a problem for the bean counters.
That's right. And the tariff's not a new issue. Right. I mean, this has always been an issue for all products in the US, in different countries, different circumstances, different products. Some have no tariffs, some do have tariffs, but when you're assembling stuff, it's different. It's not like the shirt I'm wearing, the shirt you're wearing. I mean, these are fairly simple products. It's already a consumer product completed somewhere else. When you have large, complex products, right, it's going to be home building as well, right? A lot of your prefab is from overseas. They transport over and they help prefab the home, but your lumber may be from Canada or it may be domestic, right? Your copper may be domestic, raw, going overseas, but comes back as pipe. But it may need some special coating where you send to Canada, then it comes back over again, right? It's these kind of complexities on it where people are understood the system, and now no one knows what the system's going to look like. And then, like I said, it's when you do assembly, it's not as simple as saying, this is the price. It's up to the wholesaler and the manufacturer, and then now the retailer to decide how that's going to play out. And when prices go up, it doesn't go down because deflation is bad. Deflation is bad. It starts a death spiral of the economy where you can't pay for anything anymore. It's just a death spiral of wages and prices. So then that leaves a stagflation. So the Friday unemployment number, big issue. If unemployment continues to tick up, inflation holds steady or goes up, that means at some point consumers just seize up and stop spending.
Boy, certainly uncertain times for sure.
You won't feel it for months. I mean, some of you may feel it right away. Businesses will definitely feel it right away. But consumers, it's not like, you're buying like giant rolls of toilet paper every week, right? You buy, most of us buy stuff in phases, right? When you run out of a product, you go pick up some more. Some stuff you feel right, like people feel milk right away. Most of us will buy milk almost on a weekly basis, right? Same with eggs is almost a weekly basis. But some of these products you may not feel, like you're not going to buy a car right away. Feel it later, plus you take a loan at 6%, then you see it again, right? You may not be buying a home now, or you may not be doing an addition now, but then you decide to go put bids out, get an architect, start looking at the price structure, and then now you see what's happening, right? You're probably not going to see it until you have to buy a new suit, right? The suit may be assembled here, but your cotton's from Egypt. You buy a fancy, let's say you buy a fancy suit. But I mean, same thing with sheets. The sheets may be assembled, manufactured here, but the raw products from overseas because you want certain types of material that you personally enjoy. Yeah, I don't, your personal taste is going to dictate some of the price structure as well. The cardboard, another one, right? It's very complicated. Cardboard's, wood pulp. It's very complicated how that works out, where you get your cardboard from. Right.
Oh boy.
So, I mean, like I said, most you won't feel it right away, other than stuff you buy weekly, stuff you buy in longer stages, things that are non-perishable, particularly, paper products and so forth. Yeah, you're going to see it later. And I think that's what the administration's kind of relying on is that, again, the strength of the US consumer is such a big spending power compared to the rest of the planet by times two. The next biggest country times three to the country after that. they think that you can get, they're going to get away with it like last time because you won't feel it. Because we didn't feel it
Right.
in a way. And then they're just going to blame somebody else. So blame the Democrats, they'll blame some country, they'll blame anybody but them, you know, when you start feeling the pinch. That's the MO. We're going to blame Democrats. We're going to blame somebody. But, you know, it wasn't us. And then, you know, and then he's trying to use his, you know, tariff power, hard power. But not surprising, you know, like I said, other countries are planning ahead on, you know, how to balance domestic product versus foreign product. And then they're going to find new buyers. And, well, you know, when they discover we're not a trustworthy business partner, they're going to diversify. And again, even though we're the biggest consumer on the planet by far and none, you know, there's still other consumers out there.
It's some is better than none, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely correct. And you're going to find another trade partner somewhere. Because that's what, as a business guy, that's what you got to do. You got to start looking for new markets. The market you have isn't reliable. And, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But like I said, you know, the news can talk about all it wants, but you and I, as a consumer, will feel it later. But we'll feel it eventually.
We're at the end of the hour, Techie.
Yeah. You know, it's April Fool's, everyone. We're never really here. This one broadcast is April Fool's Day. You know, the status is open. It is quiet. There are a lot of briefings going on. I'm happy to see people coming back to the State House, you know, advocates in particular, you know, come back and talk to us in person as opposed to getting a bunch of emails. And also, you know, high school kids and scouts and other activities for young folks coming through the State House will hopefully pick up more and more. I'm always happy to see a very busy State House. So,
School vacation week is coming up, so yeah.
school vacation's coming up. Yep, budget. That's when we start the budget week. You're going to probably see me half awake during that week.
Okay.
We're still in room 42 of the State House. That hasn't changed. 617-722-2370. 617-722-2370 is the number. Again, if the person doesn't pick up, it's an automated system. If the phones get inundated, just be patient. Please be patient and wait for the prompts to go through. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tackey.chan@mahouse.gov. My email is crazy right now. You're getting to the budget process, people are advocating for the various items. So it's getting crazy, as well as meetings. Oh my God, the meeting requests are really picking up. You have Tacky Chan, State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. You can see my comings and goings, as well as at Tacky Chan at X. You have tackychain.org as our resource page and our contact page as well. And, you know, malegislature.gov. You don't actually need me to track a bill. Go to malegislature.gov, open an account for free, and you can do a lot of your own legislative research about me. And of course, you know, we have Joe here at QATV. Hopefully, we can get the schedule back on the roll on a weekly, bi-weekly basis. But also, lastly, a couple of quick things. We remind people of tax days rolling around. The senior circuit breaker for senior citizens who are 65 and above and meet certain qualifications. You got to remember to take advantage of that. You turn 65 at the end of 2024, even if it's just one spouse out of two of the home. Definitely, you know, look into that. And I would just want to say congratulations to Kathy Quigley for her retirement. The YMCA, some of you may know her from the Germantown Neighborhood Center. I've known her for close to 30 years at this point in my life. You know, always working with folks to try to help people out at so many different levels. And I hear a lot of stories, obviously, from a lot of folks about her. So, you know, great job, Kathy. You're going to miss you. But I know you're not really going to be gone either. One, you're a constituent, and two, you know how to find me.
Yeah, Kathy is a great warm-hearted soul for sure. She helped a lot of people.
Absolutely. So we're going to miss you, but I know you're going to find something else to do.
Thanks so much, Jackie. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Joe.